How are you doing?
Good, how are you? Hang
Yeah.
on, let me turn off a video.
That
There we go.
was a little unexpected. All right. Let's add some people here, shall we?
Sure. Tell me when you're starting recording and I'll stop eating crackers.
Oh, we record from the get-go.
Oh, a mouthful of crackers?
Oh, definitely.
Awesome.
All right. Go find out who Tracy is. Joining us tonight. Yeah, she's popular with the Tome Show. They like her over there.
Flourish saturation, so.
Good evening, guys.
That Randall?
Hey, how you doing?
Not
Yeah, it
bad.
is.
How are you doing, man?
Good, all right. I got a dachshund climbing all over me, but other than that, I'm all right.
How's my gain? Is my gain too loud, or is it good?
No, you sound.
No, you're coming in.
You sound great.
That was just what I was gonna say.
It's like Sam's not picking up his phone.
Well, that's the first time I've ever seen busy. He must have a, maybe he's on another call.
Yeah, he just might be.
So I finally was able to get into the website, Dad, so.
Nice. Good.
Yeah.
What do you think of my take on that ritual?
I like it. Although I tell you what, the most confusing thing about that is I looked at the Dragonomicon from cover to cover. That ritual is not in that book.
Really?
Yeah, I don't.
I mean, I just copied it straight from the compendium online,
Right.
and it references it as being Draconomicon, so.
Yeah, and so does the character builder. But I looked at it cover to cover. It's not in the rituals section, and I looked at all of the other, I tried to look everywhere else, like maybe it was part of an adventure, or it was under a monster description, or anything else, and it is not in that book.
Well, maybe Mike knows. Mike,
The
do
rituals.
you know where the Cauldron's Rebirth ritual is published?
No, I don't really follow rituals.
Oh, well, it was nice having you on the podcast. We'll be.
Great, thanks. No, that's actually one area I've been totally a slack ass is other than like, Raise Dead. And I've got one of my players is a his epic destiny is a key bearer, which I guess has a lot of portal stuff.
Right.
And so he does lots of portals, but we hand wave almost all the rituals. We just, I mean, they get to kind of do what they want, and if there's enough time and it fits well in the story, then they get to do it. We don't really, I don't apply cost to those things. I don't follow the rules on rituals at all. And it would seem Wizards isn't really supporting them a whole lot either. So, who knows?
I'm like that with skill challenges, so.
Yeah, I'm actually a little bit more rigid with skill challenges. Not rigid exactly, but I've been playing a lot more with skill challenges than
Yeah.
other stuff. And the only ones that my group really seems to not hate are the ones that are embedded into combat. And I really like those too. Where an evil pillar has to be deactivated in the middle or it's going to keep growing with necrotic energy or something
Right,
like that.
right.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I enjoy skill challenges as a player, or rituals as a player, because they're a really good way to break skill challenges, and they're fun to watch DMs pull their hair out over, so.
Yeah, that is true. You can do a lot of breaking if you do that, so.
I'd actually like to see rituals get tied more into the skills themselves so that some of the lower level rituals are actually just part of running a skill. Where a lot of them, detect magic and knock and those stuff. I'd like to see those tied to the arcane skill.
Well, I thought Knock was tied to the arcane skill, but I mean,
It
they're
is, but
always
it's a
just like,
ritual.
yeah, loosely tied to it. Well, I mean, it would be easy enough for a DM to just kind of run their rituals that way. Just say,
Sure.
whatever the related whatever the related skill is to it. You know, you just make that skill challenge instead of following the standard rules. And
sure.
But to each his own.
Yep. I've been digging my new essentials stuff that came in, so.
Yeah.
That rules compendium book, and I've got the Heroes of the Fatherlands or whatever. They are some slick text.
Okay, so
I'm digging it.
Yep.
So Sam and Tracy are both recording on the Tom Show tonight, so.
Okay. Ooh. So they'll be done in a little bit then, probably.
Fancy. Yeah, I look at the Heroes of the Fallen Lands. I mean, the rules compendium is great, but it's essentially all the rules we knew,
right?
That are updated and errated. So it's a great book and it's worth having, but it's not a game changer,
right? Sure.
Heroes of the Fallen Lands feels like a different game to me, and not in a bad way.
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this and I look at the I wish this was what came out two years ago.
Really?
Because my game would be totally different if this was the book that came out. This and the next one, I would assume.
Yeah.
It's so much better balanced. There's, you know, I imagine it's a much faster game to play.
But you know what? I wonder with four character classes if it would have been too much of a culture shock I mean, you got 3.5 that had, 500 classes by the time it was wrapped up.
And now 4E has 500 classes.
Yeah.
Well, almost. It seems like it anyway. But, I mean, 3.5 really did have a whole bunch of classes all these, you know, extra things and stuff. And then you all of a sudden you release a game, and you're calling it 4E, and then you're down to four classes. I think the culture shock would have been pretty
heavy. If this was the only book that came out and the Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms didn't come out simultaneously, that would be the case. But if both books came out simultaneously, then you have your 10 races and 8 classes.
That's true. And you're right about that.
It's actually as many as the PHB1 had, only now they run right.
Right.
And they're faster to play.
But
in most cases.
I mean, do you think that maybe with just such a small amount of options for powers and whatnot, you don't think that people would have been crying foul on that one too?
I don't think they would have been, but I think they are now.
Really?
You know, I think at the time the fighter was a fighter, and to see a fighter running like the Slayer and the Knight in this would have been about right. They'd probably go, "Wow, there's actually a few more options for my fighter than I typically had." But now we are absolutely used to having every class has, you know, at wills, encounters, and dailies. And as soon as you put out a class that says, you know, "Oh, actually, you only get a handful of powers instead of this giant." You know, giant pile of powers that you would get with every, you know, I mean, every second level I have, you know, I'm playing a fighter in whatever it is, the Living Forgotten Realms, and every other level I have like 11 possible options to choose.
Well, okay, so I guess we have a differing opinion on that one, because I feel like how to put it without just not sounding like a complete jackass. I guess I'll just go with being
a jackass.
Like I always am.
I can take it.
Well,
it's just your opinion, dude. It's okay. Relax.
For me, it's you know, the idea that fighters had options, and they still do. You know, it's not like, oh no, now your fighter doesn't get the option of having these powers. I feel like a lot of people are having this reaction of, oh great, now I'm going to start essentials only campaigns, and a lot of players are not going to like that. I think what a lot of players will like is having the option to play this more classic style
and
fight.
Here's my problem. If you do not run an essentials only campaign, so obviously I'm almost completely focused on the DM side of things.
Right.
And to me, all of the balance that is back in this book is worthless when you allow everything else. Like I can't think of a single rogue who is not going to pick Daggermaster as their Paragon path, because it's far more powerful than the Paragon paths that exist in this book. Which means, why did they bother to have a Paragon path in here that is clearly not as good as what you could get with Daggermaster?
Right, but can you take an essential rogue and use him with non-essentials Paragon classes?
I would assume so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd assume. Right, there's one Paragon path in here called Master Thief. And you can follow that, but my assumption is that you could just as easily say, well, I'm going to not pick Paragon Master Thief. I'm going to pick another Paragon path.
Well, without allowing them to use non-essentials Paragon paths, aren't you then just limiting your thief to one Paragon path?
Yeah, and I think that's good.
Oh. but see, to me, it's kind of an academic argument, Mike, but only because it's, I mean, a party generally has one thief, so the party doesn't know any different. Maybe the one thief is a little less powered than the other one, but one, if, and we're setting power gaming stuff aside, I mean, the party itself isn't going to care. It's still the rogue in the party, and they're going to perform certain functions. So I think it's kind of an academic argument, at least as far as actual gameplay is concerned. So I mean, that's my opinion. I don't know.
I mean, I haven't played an Essentials game, and honestly, I don't think the differences are going to be noticeable until you start getting into, you know, above level 6. And certainly it's going to become more and more noticeable the closer you get to Paragon and into Paragon and then close to Epic and then into Epic. I think at that point, that's when you're going to see the major differences between Essentials-only classes and classes that are allowed everything. And I think the power difference is going to be... the power difference between different characters is going to be pretty extreme between Essentials only and open. But I think there's actually a duality. There's a study that I had to go find and cite while I was you know, looking into this stuff. And it was about a study they did with selling jams in a grocery store. And they had two different tables, one that had 6 jams on it and one that had 24 jams on it. And the majority of people that came into the store went to the display that had 24 jams. Many more went to that display than the one that had 6. But the one that had 6 sold a lot more jam than the one that had 24, which means that people prefer more options but don't actually use them.
Well, right.
It makes them worse.
There have been a multitude of psychological studies on how larger amounts of choices actually hinder you from making a choice.
Yeah, and you make worse choices the more information you have.
But for me, it's, you know, it's, oh man, I'm just having a hard time formulating my thoughts because there's a lot of stuff I want to say, but
let me finish my duality problem here.
Right.
So the problem with Essentials is that players aren't going to, this is a very bold statement, I think many players aren't going to like an Essentials only class because of those limitations, even though it would probably be more fun to play. Because games are going to go faster, they're going to know what they're going to want to do. You know, there's a lot of nice things about running this. But I think it's going to get lost because we already have 2 years with so many options.
For me, the choices for me have always been about differentiating your characters. So one rogue at level 6 is going to look completely different than another rogue at level 6 because every level they've got 12 different powers to choose from. And so you can kind of craft your rogue to, I mean, just be completely different than when you played in your last game. So you can still play two rogues and play two completely different characters. And I know that's also based on roleplay. And when you get into Paragon, like you said, it's going to be even different. Like the way you branch off is insanely just apples and oranges. You know, you choose a different Paragon path, and suddenly your character just plays completely different. And then into Epic tier. I think that for me, just the option of being able to differentiate, I understand that more likely than not, if you give me more options to choose from, there's more of a chance that I'm going to make a bad choice. But those are all my choices to make. And you make a bad choice, and that often gives your character. You know, having flaws and not being perfect. And the idea of...
Sure.
I'd argue that there's no such thing as a bad choice when it comes to this kind of thing. But that's, you know...
Yeah, it all depends on your motivation.
Yeah. And when it,
right, exactly. That's an old school way of thinking. I realize that. That goes way back. But yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah. But go ahead, Dad. Sorry.
That's called character.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But the... You know, the idea that... I'm losing my train of thought since I can't be interrupted right now. I've just got too much going on.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's all good. you know, the idea that there's more balance in this book than the other book, or in this system than the previous system, balance goes out the window as soon as my players sit down at the table, because I've got a couple players who are power gamers, and I got a couple guys who are power role players, and so I've got a couple guys who... You know, no matter what books you put in front of them, they are going to hit for an insane amount of damage, and they're never going to miss, and they're going to fail every skill challenge. And I've got a couple other guys who really could care less if they hit in combat, but they love the role-playing and they love the skill challenges. So balance, I mean, balance is kind of a nebulous ghost that we're always chasing, but it really depends on, you know, whose hands the tools are in, you know?
Right. I think you certainly can't find a perfect balance in anything, and I'm sure there's things that are imbalanced in this. I think there's more balance in this. I think there'd be more balance in any system where you limit the choices that people can make. And the minute you leave it open, like I have in my game, you know, in my game, they can have anything and they can have any feat and any power from any Dragon magazine where some guy came up with something really crazy.
Yeah.
And I see it and I see the results. And I don't think I would see those same results with something like this. And the one very specific example I can bring up is with critical hits. Where in the Player's Handbook 1, there are many options to increase the threat range of your critical hit. And in this, there aren't any.
Right.
And that, just right off the bat, that puts a whole new balance on things. When you can only crit on a 20, now the damage output of characters goes down significantly compared to, you know, I keep bringing up Dagger Master because it's the extreme example of being able to crit on an 18, 19, or 20.
Right.
And, you know, it immediately changes the overall amount of damage that they can throw out there.
But when looking,
and I'd prefer to play this way.
When looking to streamline encounters, wouldn't having a higher damage output and letting the characters kind of be able to mow through things a little faster be, or are you just worried about the fact that encounters won't be fun because?
Well, it's really hard to threaten them.
Right.
I mean, I seriously had a 1,000 hit point creature that died in 7 turns, you know, died in a round and a half. And it died because two guys, I think in 2 rounds, there was over 350 damage per round, per turn. And, you know, it was all based on critical hits. It was based on a combination of critical hits.
Okay.
So, and you know, and that was level 26 or something like that. So we're talking pretty, at the higher end of the spectrum is when things get totally out of whack. But that's the area I'm in right now, and I've got to run, you know, 7 more games and still have it be fun, and I have to just completely throw the rule books out the window in order to make a challenging battle at this point.
But isn't that always been the DM's job, is just kind of chuck the rules when you have to and make it...
Sure, and I'm having a great time, don't get me wrong. I'm not like, oh god, I have to run an epic game. I mean, I love it, and I love what we're doing, and I cannot wait to run some of the monsters that I have in mind. You know, I don't think that an inexperienced DM should be running epic games without knowing exactly what you're going to be into. But I mean, like, the, you know, certain things like the idea of an experience budget for monsters, just throw it out
right.
The window. You know, the idea that a minion counts for experience at all, get rid of that. You know, I seriously had in the last game, they had 2 waves of 30 minions that they killed, where they killed every single minion without even a roll.
Jeez.
There was no die roll. They killed every single one of them. And it was a huge map, and they killed every one of them on the map. And it was a combination of a warlord and a ranger. And the warlord gave the ranger +8 to her attack roll. And with her already extended attack bonus, that meant that she hit on a 1. And she had a thing that said, I get to hit every single thing I can see. And she just fired, and that was the end of that.
Jeez.
Yeah, and then the next time they all turned into undead. They were all like normal guys, and then they all got resurrected as skeletons. And then the cleric used Turn Undead and got the same boost from the Warlord. So now he was +8 to hit, and he just rolled it. And it, for him, it was also a 1. So, I mean, and that's fine. You know, I said, look, I didn't throw 30 minions on the table so that they'd be hard. You know, I knew they'd be killed. It would have been nice if you had to roll to kill them. But, you know, it was flavor. And what it said is, you guys are superheroes. And when you walk into a, you know, a big, you know, cult gathering of Orcus guys, that means you get to kill them all.
Yep.
So it worked out.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing minions be changed a little bit to see if, you know, like staggered, what I call like staggered effect minions, where you hit them and then they change into something else.
Sure.
The one hit knocks them down once and then they change, you know, and then something, another kind of, I mean, it happens in MMOs all the time, so, you know.
Sure.
But,
and I've been doing a lot of kind
of
immunities. Hello.
Hey, Sam.
I've been using a lot of immunities to prevent minions from getting completely wiped out. So I'll have minions that are immune to area attacks or immune to, you know, they can only be hit by, you know, melee strikes. And that way you have to kill them a certain way. You know, you have to walk around and hit each one, and that prevents them from getting completely destroyed.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
But I mean, and then sometimes you just want them to get completely destroyed. You don't want to ruin the fun of killing 30 guys with a single shot. I mean, the players loved it. They're like, woohoo. You know, I just would have liked a little bit more flavor with that, but it worked out. I mean, it was part of the story.
Well, have you ever, I mean, maybe it was even you that had suggested giving minions save roll on their first hit.
I think somebody else suggested that. I saw that.
I think that was me.
Because I've played with that, and it actually works really well, especially when the first time, because players aren't used to it, and it really psychs them out, because, guys are minions. Yeah. Then I'll roll, and I'll be like, yeah, he's not dead. And I'll even let them roll damage.
That's actually a really good idea, because it's something where you don't have to maintain a state. You don't have to, like, track a hit point. You don't have to track whether or not it got hit before.
Right, right.
You know, if you just roll a saving throw every... I mean, you could actually do that every time.
Right, and then it gives them...
You know? Well, because, where I first did that was I was using some baby slods, and the slods have a power where if the first time they get hit, they can teleport. Right. Or maybe I just reskinned another creature. But so that's where I got that, and I was like, you know, it would be awesome to have all minions be able to get hit twice. You know, yeah. So that's why I did it. I'm sure it's not a brand new idea. I'm sure somebody else is doing it too.
Yeah. If you give every minion like a 50-50 chance to survive anything.
It gives them some staying power.
Yeah, it'll give them some staying power. That would have worked really nicely for like 30 guys.
Yeah.
You know, that figure about, you know.
Then you have the overhead of having to do that for 30 guys. But...
Well, rolling a saving throw is not something.
Well, I know, but yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like it would have been the only rolling going on in that fight anyway. So
yeah,
it's
in
not,
that fight, it would have been the only rolling. There was no attack roll.
It's,
so.
It's not like that. I don't think that would have added all that much to his fight. Not that much.
Right. Well, that's true. Yeah.
Right. I'm brainstorming right now off that. I love getting to talk to Mike about Epic Tier because, you know, out of all the games I've DM'd, none have yet to make it to Epic Tier. And so my experience, as I always say, my experience with Epic Tier is a little limited. And so getting to hear his take on it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I really like it, but it's something that has to be, it's something that has to, a lot of time has to be spent figuring it out.
Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
How was the Tome Show?
It was good.
Awesome.
I got some words in.
Cool.
What, was that a dig? Was that...
No, yeah? Not at all.
No?
No.
She's... Her first words on this, and she's already taking digs at me.
Out of love, man.
You're out of love? I can tell.
No. It's out of love.
Wait, isn't that a song? I'm all out of love. Like that.
I'm so lost without you. What?
There you go. Thank you, Sam.
There you go.
Yeah. I wasn't gonna go there.
I didn't hear anything. All I did was, I was getting a woodchuck because Tracy is making me drink woodchuck this week, and I put my headphones on and I heard, you know, I'm all out of love. So you know, how can you not complete the lyric? It's perfect.
That's right.
What is a woodchuck?
Woodchuck is hard cider. Well, a woodchuck is a small marmoset-type animal that lives in the East Coast and burrows underground.
Right.
A woodchuck like a hard cider is a drink.
I've got scotch tonight, so.
Nice.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm going booze-free tonight, so.
Nice.
Randall, did you see my tweet earlier about classic rock?
Yes, I did, and I meant to respond to that, but I was like in the middle of eating my salad, so it was like it all passed by. But I saw that, and I totally respected that comment, though. So,
yeah,
classic rock is the stuff that
old men listen to.
It's classic because it's good.
When they want to put on their denim jackets and ride their non-existent motorcycles, anyway. We were just discussing. Originally, we were discussing essentials and the builds, and it was a little bit of a discussion about how Mike felt that the paring down of choices made for a much much more exciting game, whereas I'm actually kind of a fan of the choices, and so
it would make for a more streamlined game,
which in some definitions would be a more exciting or a more enjoyable game.
Yeah, the rounds are good quick.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking I'm going to approach it with my players as here are the Essentials characters. They're a little simpler. They're simpler builds because there's not as much decision making. I'm going to allow them to play side by side with the regular, 4E characters. It'll be just I just explained to them basically that what it comes down to is instead of choosing powers all the time at certain levels, you'll just get additional class features, and those will allow you to do certain things. And that's basically the difference right there in a nutshell. So, it's less choosing for them. So if they want something a little easier to run and less overhead for them, choose an Essentials character. Otherwise, it's just fine if you go with the other ones, and you can run them side by side. So I'm not going to be running any Essentials-only campaigns, I don't think. So unless my players are just going to specifically ask for that, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure the wizard and the cleric are all that much more streamlined, to be perfectly honest.
No, they're not.
The only thing
that's streamlined with the wizard and the cleric is the paragon paths are much narrower. Paragon paths, and there's only one epic destiny, and right. The paragon paths and epic destinies are much more streamlined, obviously. Just because of one. Yeah, I'll probably run. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do. When my current campaign's over, my next campaign's going to be Dark Sun. And for Dark Sun, I'll probably open the gates and let people choose whatever they want, but it's going to be lower level. And then I think anytime...
I thought you said I was going to open the gates of hell, but anyway.
No, I'll be doing that too. Yeah, although there's no real hell there, but they're on Athas, so it's already hell. But I think anytime I'm going to be running a Paragon game or above, I'll probably narrow it down to Essentials and maybe a few other things. Because I I saw this huge power jump at Paragon and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger as it went to Epic. And looking at how things are in Essentials, I don't think that power jump is going to be quite as extreme. So that will be nice.
One of the things I wanted to talk about while we're on the subject of Essentials is I don't think a lot of people have talked about, and it sounds like a silly thing, but the actual aesthetics of the product. I'm not just talking about the artwork or the layout and things like that, but I noticed something really strange when I had these two books side by side, The Rules Compendium and The Heroes of the Fallen Lands. And if you set them side by side on the tile box set, it fits perfectly.
If you set them side by side on the red box, they fit perfectly too.
I know, and it's like, was this a design idea? Did someone say, well, some nerd's going to put them all in a box and they're going to want them to stack nice because they're going to have to carry them to conventions and stuff. It's like, let's make it like this. And it's like, I'm really dying to find out if that was a design feature or total accident. And
I lied. They don't fit directly on the red box, but the red box is deep enough. If you take out that ridiculous triangle insert, it's deep enough to fit everything in there.
Right.
So, sorry for interrupting. I wanted to clarify that before somebody sends me an email.
That's okay. And I'm actually referring to the tile box set. And it won't fit. The books won't fit side by side within the tile box set, but they sit on top, so that it all stacks. And it was like, oh, well, that's kind of cool, actually. And I was appreciating. I showed it to a couple of friends of mine, a couple of my players today, and it was like they were all surprised at the weight. And the density, the actual density of the book, it's like, wow, this actually feels... And they were impressed with the size. They thought, And if anything at all, the Rules Compendium is a huge game changer for me only because of the way I can use it at the table. I can set this book right down beside the rest of my notes. It does not take up a bunch of space. I can open it easily. It's light, it's maneuverable. I don't know how better to put it. But I just... The aesthetics of the book are just impressive. And it's something that I haven't seen before. You're used to these unwieldy tomes, since the old days. And this is a very or the flimsy. It's like one way or the other. It was these big heavy tomes or these flimsy paperish things that, you were worried about damaging. And this seems like a really nice mix between the two. So
yeah.
Do you guys
find yourself referencing the rules pretty often during your games?
It comes up two or three times. I actually had a rule where I called out on the internet, and I think it was Wolf, I think it was Aaron that actually answered my question about stacking resistances, and it was like I had forgotten, had a brain freeze on it and couldn't remember what the rules were on it, and I actually used Twitter to answer that, but the Rules Compendium would have been nice to have to easily indexed and check it out.
I
didn't have it at that point.
I don't normally. I'm the type of, I don't bring any books in general to the, yeah, to the game. But when I got the compendium, I decided to bring it along a couple of times. So for a couple of weeks now, I had it. And normally I just make a ruling on the fly. And if one of my players really wants to debate it or question it, we do it after the game. But you know, the compendium does what it's meant to do. And I do actually have a newish player in my group now. And I sort of let him hang on to it for the whole session last time. And he was taking a bit of interest in it. So, you know, it's nice. You're right. It's small and it's a good compact size and it has really good information in it. So yeah, it's good, but I don't generally have my books at the table so I can just open them up and check a rule, but you know.
Well, to answer your question, when I was much newer at DMing, I was really unsure of myself. And so I guess, I would always want the rules to be right. And the more that I DM, I have found that I just, you know, I'm more sure of myself, so I just make a ruling. And then if the players mm-hmm. want to challenge me on it, they can do it later. But I'm pretty good about stopping arguments before they get started. And, you know, my players know that they can, if they have a question about the rules, they can just pick up the rules compendium and look it up and then bring it up to me. But they know not to ask me a question and then make me go looking it up, you know, stopping what's going on.
Yeah, there's still a few edge cases that aren't exactly covered in here. You know, there was a couple of rules that I've always had a hard time with, like whether or not you can you slide somebody into an area effect that somebody else has created? And usually the answer is yeah, you can. But then can you stagger it so that you get to slide him in and out and in and out if you slide four, for example? And then does he take damage every time he goes in or not? And I didn't quite get that covered in here. But I think everything that's pointing towards says, yeah, if you want to throw somebody into a, you know, blade barrier four times because you're able to slide eight, and nobody's able to slide eight, but if you want to push him in two times because you can slide four, then you can.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
and then he'll take damage when he starts.
Yeah, because to those effects are like terrain features then. And so anytime you're impacting a terrain feature, that's going to happen.
Well, that's the interesting bit is hazardous terrain allows a saving throw. So if it was actually a terrain feature, they would get a save when they get pushed right. into it. But because it's not a terrain feature,
okay.
because it's a power, right. they don't get a save. That was actually, you know. So it's little weird things like that that are kind of covered in here.
Yeah, I usually do something like split the difference with them. You know, I'll give them the first slide and I'll give them a save on the second slide.
For a while, I just said you get one damage per round, so...
Tracy, do you have a lot of rules discussion at the table, or use your compendium much?
I haven't used the compendium much, only because we haven't played much since it came out. But yeah, they like to look up the rules. They'd much rather have the rule than sometimes. They're also pretty good, like, if it doesn't really matter, they'll be like, whatever you decide, Tracy is cool. But
that's
I know...
Decide.
Yeah, that's the really funny part. It's as soon as they know that there's a situation coming up, like with stealth or aquatic combat, they're already turning the pages, and I'm like, listen, guys, I knew this one was coming up. I may already know the answer.
But yeah. I would prefer that my players were already looking it up than, you know, just stopping and in the middle of the gameplay and being like, hey, wait, you know, what's the rule on this? Will you look it up? I'd rather... You know, if they want to come ready and armed with the rules, then so be it. You know, I'll abide unless it's something I really want to change. I just don't. I'm never happy when they want to stop everything and have me go look something up online or thumb through a book.
Oh, yeah. No, they're very good. We talked about it pretty early when I started DMing because I was brand new to most of D&D still. So while I maybe knew the rules just as well, if not actually a little better than they did, it just didn't make sense for me to take time away from all the other stuff I had to run at the table to do the lookup. So we anointed a person to be the rules lookup person. The problem now is that, you know, he pulls out the PHB1 and I'm like, dude, no.
You better be looking at pictures if you're pulling that thing up. It's not good for anything else.
And I feel terrible because he really likes books, you know, so he wants to look it up in the book, and I'm just like, it's not in there anymore. Yeah.
This one.
He needs a rules compendium for Christmas.
Yeah, right.
Right. Well, and I have one for my table.
By Christmas, will the rules compendium still be valid?
Probably.
Shush. Hush you.
I mean, 2 years. You know, 2 years of updates. I don't think they're going to put a lot more. I mean, most of the errata is going to be power errata and errata to specific things. I don't think you're going to see a lot of errata for the base rules.
Right. Didn't they actually, like, one of them that just got promoted, didn't he say that one of his main... Was it Mike Merles? Yeah, one of his main jobs is to reduce the amount of errata that comes out.
Yeah, well, that's going to be hard. That means you're going to have a lot of imbalanced stuff that comes out and never gets fixed.
Right.
There's actually one, I was just looking through here, one thing that speaks pretty well to this book. There's one weird edge case of a rule that we've always tried to figure out, which is immobilization and teleports. You know, we've always kind of house ruled that depending on whether or not the immobilization is physical, a teleport, if an immobilization is physical, a teleport will remove it. And if it's psychic or mental, then it won't. And I always thought that was kind of a loose rule. And it's actually in here. You know, page 214 says exactly that if...
Oh, wow.
If it teleports away from a physical restraint or a monster's grasp or other immobilizing effect that is located in a specific space, the target is no longer immobilized or restrained. Otherwise, the target teleports, but it's still immobilized.
Nice.
So that's a pretty, you know, the fact that it covers an edge case that detailed is pretty good. Now, of course, they've been getting emails for 2 years on weird stuff like that. Yeah. So.
Right.
You know, it's too bad this doesn't have chapter and verse numbers in it. It would be like a Bible.
Yeah.
Wait, should I not say that? Maybe I shouldn't say that.
I got to get a copy of this for my rules lawyer.
Is that too controversial? It's like chapter 1, verses 3-5. Exposure. A creature that is, you know.
I think more than like that, being controversial, I think that would make the rules lawyers just that much more dangerous.
Thanks be to wizards? I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
The thing is, sometimes you just need to, you know, have your rules lawyer's character killed. Like I do. you're the rules lawyer, but that doesn't mean I can't bring out a demi lich.
Nice. I can definitely kill you within the rules, too. I mean.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. See, the thing with my
story, I used to have to
say something and...
Whoa.
No, that's all right.
That was weird. So I used to have this rules lawyer in my group that... at the beginning of fourth edition when I started playing, and he was a great guy. Like, he was really sort of happy-go-lucky. He wasn't like an aggressive rules lawyer, but the problem was he was a 3.0 player. So instead of being like the confident, sure rules lawyer, like, no, the rule is blah, 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 he would be like, well, in 3.0, the rule was this and this and this. Did that change? And it was really like an honest question, sort of, but it wasn't really a question. It was more like, are you sure you're doing it right, but in a more polite way, kind of. It was odd, but all I had to do was talk to him and he stopped, so it was fine.
Okay, well, it's time to change the subject just a little bit. We're gonna talk a little bit about how much Mike and I love Dungeons and why Tracy had to go and start war on Dungeons. Declare war on all Dungeons.
Don't hate the Dungeons.
Man, last night, Mike, when you sent those tweets on Twitter, I was like, it sounds like he thinks I'm killing his puppy. I'm not killing the puppy. you're like, but I love, they make me feel like I'm 14. I was like, oh,
well,
I'm sorry. No,
it's called euthanasia. It's not killing the puppy. It's just euthanasia.
Poor Dungeons. All they want to do is eat players and look at you.
Well, I think that...
Look what you're doing. Don't hurt
the
Dungeons.
And be illogical.
I think that's that statement, illogical. Come on. We've had this conversation before. Flying wizards shooting fireballs out of their hands and, you know.
That has internal
There's rules for that.
Yeah. Right.
I get what you mean. There's a gremlin rule. This is one of my favorite rules. The gremlin rule. And the gremlin obviously comes from the movie Gremlins, where, you know, if they outline, and this is the argument for Tracy's point of view, if the story outlines that if you spill water on them, they multiply, and then if they eat after midnight or whatever that happens, they turn into really nasty things, then that's consistent. But the minute you put one into the driver's seat of a remote control car and he can drive around from the inside, then all disbelief is lost. Right? Because you know that nothing can drive a remote control car from the inside.
Right.
Right.
So just like that.
Except
like,
a gremlin, you know, apparently. But
we know, right, we know that rules. Well, if it was telepathic or telekinetic,
right,
we could
exactly.
understand it. And actually, the interesting in the movie Toy Story, they all ride around in a remote control car because one of them is holding the remote.
Right.
And then they knew what they were doing.
That's true.
So the idea that, yeah, there's no internal consistency for dungeons whatsoever. Why are these giant mazes here? And how come there's how is it for 800 years a gelatinous cube has sat one room away from three orcs and neither of them ate each other?
Right. And then, so, like, it doesn't make any sense to me, but yet I'm told that dailies make no sense for fighters at all. We can never have that because that's just, it breaks all logic.
Well, I will say that that does kind of break logic, though. Can you think of any actually physical thing that somebody can do once a day, and they can do it once a day, but never
sex appears once a day?
Speak for yourself, dude. That's not
true. For some, there, medically speaking, for some people, the refractory period is greater than 24 hours.
Poor bastards.
Yeah, I feel for them.
That's like. Is there a telethon or something for that? I mean, really, I would donate to that cause, but you know,
it's true though.
No, they developed a bunch of drugs. They're called Viagra.
It became a really huge back to the industry.
Sorry, dungeons. We're talking about dungeons, right?
But to Mike's point, I mean, at the same time, we already make exceptions for wizards because there is no way that somebody that intelligent is just going to freaking forget their most powerful spell right after they do it.
Ah, but if it's arcane energy, they could actually lose that energy and not be able to get that energy back because it's a whole different physical system.
What I was told, that's not the answer, though. The answer is that they just forget it.
Told by whom?
You know.
Yeah.
I want a source.
Yeah.
Name.
Is it an official WotC source?
Name source didn't happen.
Compendium anywhere.
No.
And I've read this cover to cover.
Wait, and which one?
The Rules Compendium. I didn't see anything about losing the memorization. But I think,
go ahead.
When it comes to dungeons, actually, I hate to like come to the conclusion of the argument beforehand. I think what you're, and this is where 140 characters doesn't really do justice to it. What you don't like, and I'm putting words in your mouth, so completely say no, you don't know what you're talking about. I believe what you don't like is when you have a giant maze of totally random stuff that has no, that makes no, like a big room that has one door that is 10 feet wide but has a 40-foot dragon in it. And no idea how the dragon got there, no idea what the dragon eats. There's no ecology to it.
And why the hell did they spend that much money? Do you know how much money it takes to hire that many dwarves to sit there and do this? Like, why would they ever do that? It doesn't make any sense at all. But it's Dungeons and Dragons, so exactly. I'm supposed to just accept it.
But there's a, I think early on in one of the books, I don't remember, I think it was actually in the basic set, and I think I was reading it from your copy at Gen Con, they describe their definition of a dungeon. And a dungeon is actually a very wide category of things like crypts underneath a church and sewer systems below a city and ancient ruins that have been buried over time and caverns that are, you know, volcanic inside. There's lots of actual reasons why they would be there. And I think, you know, any most modern, watch me while I completely just put, you know, define the world. Many good dungeon masters understand that in order to have a dungeon that actually works right, it needs to have a reason to exist and it needs to make sense. But it can still be a dungeon.
Right.
Under the looser definition of the term dungeon.
See, I like to, when using dungeons, I like to, and I posted this on your site in response to your latest article, but I like to take a book out of, or a page out of, you know, something like Lord of the Rings, where the party enters a dungeon because they have to get from one place to another, and their only viable option is to go through this dwarven city, which has become a quote-unquote dungeon. It has a reason for existing. It's an ancient dwarven city. I mean, that's why it's carved out. That's why it's such a big maze. I mean, it used to be a completely underground city. Now the dwarves are dead. Something's killed them off. And there are multiple types of monsters. You know, there's a Balrog.